me pones un ejemplo. Entonces, si tú no quieres hablar conmigo, dímelo para yo no llamarte ni molestarte, porque nada más quedaba tú.
Real talk. Real people. Real stories. The He's Just Podcast. Yeah! Welcome, everyone, to another He's Just Podcast. I'm your host and founder of the He's Just a Social Worker movement, with another amazing show for you today. But before we get started, I want to remind everyone that this platform was built because way too often as people, we were overlooked or labeled. But this is no longer. Our plight and our fight is for anyone and everyone who feels a need to be understood. We are strong as individuals, but unstoppable when we unite. There are many versions out here that have us thinking at one point or the other about the idea of the end of the world. From natural disasters, man-made catastrophes, technology risk, and even cosmic events. There are many theorists and scientists that work tirelessly to help prevent and prepare us for such threats. Meet Dr. John Mills, a distinguished philosopher, psychoanalyst, and clinical psychologist. He serves as his honorary professor in the Department of Psychosocial and Psychoanalytic Studies at the University of Essex in the UK. Additionally, Dr. Mills is a faculty member in the postgraduate programs in psychoanalysis and psychotherapy at the Gordon F. Derner School of Psychology, Adelphi University. He's also a supervising analyst at the New School for Existential Psychoanalysis. Dr. Mills has authored over 30 books and is the recipient of the prestigious Otto Wiener Memorial Award for Lifetime Achievement. Today, we delve into his most recent book, End of the World, Civilization and Its Fate, which explores the profound psychosocial and cultural dimensions of apocalyptic thinking and the existential threats confronting humanity. Dr. Mills, welcome to our show.
Thank you for having me. Very grateful.
It's such a pleasure to have you. Take us away. Tell us a little bit about yourself and how did you get involved in this journey? Tell us a little bit about your journey and your walk.
Well, this is a book that's been in the making for about the last three decades. It's certainly something I never thought I would be doing, to be honest. I was finishing my PhD in philosophy when I was taken by the question of the future of humanity, and particularly was interested in what Freud and Hegel had to say, and that led to a book and other writings of mine. But then over the years, witnessing the genocide in Rwanda, the former Yugoslavian conflicts, the overpopulation boom, the climate crisis, and all of this just kind of, been compounding over the years. And so I initiated a lot of interdisciplinary and transdisciplinary research that took me out of my realm, looking at earth sciences and anthropology and economics and artificial intelligence, and a number of domains that I wouldn't typically be reading in my field. And when the pandemic hit, we're all cooped up here for at least a couple years. So gave me an opportunity to finish this project.
Such a pleasure having you with us. You mentioned early on conflicts. Is this understanding of fear that sometimes gets us thinking about what's the worst that can happen? And I know you talked about some things that have happened in the past, whether it's environmental, most current with COVID, and other things of that nature. We're going to talk more about those things, because I think that takes place in the hearts and minds of many. What do you most appreciate about your work? Is it helping people prepare for civilization's fate, or is it prevention to help us get or do a better job to make better choices?
Well, I'm hoping that I can at least get people to talk honestly about the crisis that we face as a civilization, and not just simply engage in typical forms of denial or disavowal or disassociation from these looming threats. So if I consider myself modestly lucky, it would be people being able to talk about honestly and truthfully about the potential catastrophe that awaits us. But the hope here is that we pay attention and that we take ameliorative action while we can, rather than postpone what thousands of scientists tell us are imminent threats to our existence.
There's a lot to think about when people either reference the end of the world and what that means to them. It may mean different things. I'm thinking about your own practice here for a bit. Were you seeing any patients or seeing clients or just hearing in some of your talks that there was more concern about this and that drove you towards understanding more into your research? Or were there just the notion that we knew that there was a need for this and you felt that was the niche that was needed to be filled?
Well, I think, clinically, often people come in with their own anxieties, and some of them, are about the future, are about a climate crisis and ecological, despoliation of the planet. But many of them are more about societal implosions and divisions and how that's impacting on the economy, on their capacity to make ends meet, to keep the lights on, to have affordable housing. And often people's anxieties are more about the immediacy of their lives rather than these bigger issues. But of course, with the pandemic, it brought everything to home. We still don't even understand the fallout of what COVID 19 is going to bring in terms of our health, in terms of the consequences of our economies, of our social structures, of supply chains, of food distribution, and things like this. So people tend to think in dystopian terms, and catastrophize, but others, they are very good at using defenses to kind of live in their own Pollyannish world, where these things don't bother them, and it's out there, kind of, as an abstract notion, rather than something that hits them. But this is the thing, is that it depends where you live in the world, that you're going to feel the impact of existential risks to the globe and geopolitics differently, and the trickle effects on our everyday lives. So, for instance, I'm up here in South Central Ontario, and last summer there's wildfires, and that's an hour from my house. That's different, let's say, from people in, various parts of the world that notice very little change to their climates. But if we were to take a long look at it and look at different parts of the world, which we often don't do, we see entirely different, both climate-related, but political, economic, social, and cultural differences that what we experience. for instance, you know, it's almost 130 degrees Fahrenheit in India right now, where people are dying because it's so hot. And, you know, here we are in our you know, privileged Western lives where we have the air conditioner on. When other parts of the world, and particularly developing countries, are lucky, you know, if they survive these conditions.
It's interesting that you talk about the imbalance that sometimes we feel. As people, we often think about our own self-interest and what that's and what this may mean for our families and for our immediate sectors. Funny enough, when you talked about the pandemic, a lot of us tend to think that it never did happen, but we all did live through it. We saw a massive amount of fear being instilled into our normalcy. The jobs, the things were shut down, stores were shut down. You were hunting out here for whether it was elderberry or teas or soaps, and you were wearing masks and the type of mask that you needed to wear. So for me, there is a lot to think about when people see these major issues happen, and you referenced about the scorching temperatures that are in parts of the world now versus others that are not. This same imbalance seems to be there. I was looking just at a regular Google search, and it says that about 40% of people believe that the world is coming to an end, and 58% do not. I'm interested to think about when things are not going well, such as the pandemic, or there's war, or there's something else. Do you think these numbers change or factor when now people are saying it's an immediate threat, the world is coming to an end? Can you speak about that?
Well, you just surprised me with that figure. I wouldn't think it would be near 50%. In fact, it really is quite almost unbelievable that that half of, you know, society thinks it's that bad. But it obviously tells you how dire people's psychological lives are. If it's simply a flip of a coin, whether or not we're going to survive what's going on currently. Well, I would dissuade people from overreacting or catastrophizing to that degree. But if half of them feel that there is, you know, either a imminent social deterioration to the point of either some type of, you know, social existence that has been so depleted that we are not going to be able to really make ends meet, or we're going to be thrown back to primitive times at the very least. That's worrisome. That could lead to major, you know, mass panics about stability in our you know, social systems. So, but going with that, it also tells us about how pessimistic people have become. How is it that they don't see the future as very bright or hopeful, or that it serves as an opportunity to fulfill one's possibilities by making changes that can bring about desired futures? And that's really what we need to be thinking about. It's like, one, we have to get through this crass denialism that things, you know, whatever it may be, you have on one hand, you know, the extreme climate denialists who want to say there's nothing to worry about, it's always been this way. But even if you were to convince them that credible scientists and authorities, whether it be, you know, these groups that comprise, you know, hundreds of working groups, thousands of scientists that inform, you know, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or the World Weather Attribution, or you know, Climate Central, or whatever these groups are that are important to listen to, you would still want to have a conversation with these folks. That, but there's other things. There's other existential risks that are happening right now, and I'll grant you that one. We'll grant you that one. But how about this? Such as if you, we cannot deny that there's environmental declines in many ways. Biodiversity has been lost. Ecosystem collapses are on the horizon. And, you know, many, we have to anticipate that this is going to continue. If it does, you'll still have to respond to these emergencies. So, for instance, like if that does happen or does continue, that we still become overheating. And let's say it's not man-made. It's not part of the Anthropocene. It will still be an existential issue we must address. Because if we don't, that's just like living in some kind of fantasy land. Mm-hmm. Denial only works until the reality principle rings its little bell and we're forced to wake up. So what happens then if we look at how the deterioration of our planet can affect other things? Let's say when people don't have electricity because the grids are too stressed, you're going to have major societal issues. What happened, like up here in Calgary, for instance, and I think in the United States, there's been some water main breakage. So mm-hmm. people don't have access to water. And when you don't have access to the lifeblood of existence, that affects everything else. Food distribution, vital resources that are going to be scarce. You're going to have emergency response people that are just overwhelmed with health crises. You know, you're not going to be able to go to the hospital, or you won't get people to attend to medical or emergencies because there's just not enough personnel. And you could go on and on. You could talk about the likelihood because of our proclivity toward human aggression, evil, and the fact that we're engaged in military conflict everywhere, that there's the likelihood, and I believe a higher likelihood than a lesser likelihood, that we're going to have another world war that's going to break out.
Mm-hmm. To me, it's interesting. The word conflict or fear always lives in this for me. And in the conflict piece, I'm thinking about our third world countries. Whenever we have a major storm, Sandy, or any type of storm that really takes the world apart in certain parts of the world, you can see, as you mentioned, food being scarce, the fear level, and then the conflict, the stronger taking over, manipulating situations, which I think even heighten more the need or fear for people to stay alive and what they're willing to do during these times. There's so much that you can look at to unpack how is it that we have to survive in the things that we do. But I can tell you that even when they announce in the weather or there's a threat of a hurricane or something, you go to Costco, you go to any of these places and the shelves are empty because people think, hey, something is going to happen and I want to be prepared. So I do believe that the people are concerning themselves. You may have a family member or two who's the emergency equipment person. You have seen movies and things like that, what it may look like. But for certain, I do believe that there is something that is changing, because we're talking about finding life on Mars and doing things in different parts of the world that we probably did not think about as a people. And now we do. So I do believe that there is a lot to be said about what people have on their minds, but their actions may be a little bit different. When we're thinking about some of these theories on how the world will end, you know, from the sun burning us down, some sort of apocalyptic end of world where we meet our fate? Or is it some sort of religious belief? God is going to, you know, he's tired of this and he's going to change the world and take it over. Or maybe war and even something real kooky. Is it some sort of zombies taking us over? What are some of the things that come up for you as you were designing your thought process around how the end of the world or how our fate will eventually come?
Well, I should first of all say that I do not believe in any type of religious form of eschatology where God would decide to destroy the human race and bring back, you know, a new form of enlightened people who are into some salvation. Mm-hmm. But I do believe that people who believe in end times, such as radical Islam, could do things to bring that about, and because they believe it ardently. And it's not just Islam, but I mean, you've got Christianity, you've got Judaism that has their own eschatologies. But usually that's a very small amount of people who really think that's going to be the real end. Maybe they do, but that would be more based on faith. But for me, there would be nothing more paranoid than the thought that a divine being or entity would want to kill me. It would be other factors that are based upon, you know, human fear and anxieties and ideologies. Mm-hmm. So from that point of view, there is a potential risk that people who believe in biblical end time may do things to accelerate it, particularly if they feel that they need to initiate a war or nuclear engagement or other things, biological warfare, releasing pathogens into the air, creating the next pandemic that weeds us out. There are those things. But I would be more inclined to think that there would be more of a secular apocalypse, if anything, that would be brought about by more of this notion, that either it be the environmental tipping point that we're reaching, that the climate, that could be a catalyst to push us into, extreme states. It could be the geopolitics that are taking place, where people are, you know, using nuclear rhetoric. They are increasing and modernizing their nuclear arsenals rather than dismantling them. That's all we need, is more risk around. You do have, of course, and I believe this is a real issue, when people feel desperate, when they feel deprived, when they feel there's no security, that you're going to not only have societies that potentially could collapse, but they're going to be on the move. You're going to have increased immigration, panic, the need to flee, whether it be climate or, you know, warfare that's taking place in their countries. And that sets into motion a trickle effect or a butterfly effect that impacts on the rest of the world, because people have to attend to these humanitarian crises. So you could see, societies devolve into criminality and basic instinct for survival if they don't have, the basics, to live, food, water, shelter, things like this. So that's some of my concern, more of my concerns are those areas. But AI, yeah. AI is another one.
Yeah, we're gonna talk more about that, but I did like in your answer that sense of desperation that exists for some is a great opportunity for others. I do think that combination at the right time, the perfect storm, if you will, can drive a movement. And we must be careful as people how we choose and congregate with others, not understanding the true outliers or beliefs that people may have. So I really enjoyed an understanding from you, at least there. We could worry about people for sure. Yes, they can create situations, and those may be, in some cases, fatal. But is it enough to change the world and end it? Maybe we're looking at something that really stems from the environment, something that we've been creating, destroying for years, and we've not noticed it. And now we're starting to get the ripple effects in these pockets in different places. It may seem that it's war-driven, but really it is not. It's something that we have not probably done enough of and need to do more of to kind of support and improve our chances to change this around. Let's talk about your book, Dr. Mills. I mean, End of the World, Civilization and Its Fate. Why was this book important to you? Or why is it important to you?
Well, I think there's multiple, you know, motives and reasons for why people engage in it, in whether it be personal, intellectual, or scholarly pursuits. So I mean, I'm like anyone else. I've been concerned about whether or not we have limited time as a species, and what can I do about it? So. Usually my pattern is to meditate and study something in depth so I can fully understand what's going on. And so I'll be the first to admit that until I started researching these vast topics, I really didn't have a clue what kind of dire straits we're in. And so I felt like I better keep on it, and I better be studying other areas that are outside of my scope and expertise. But nevertheless, I feel I'm qualified enough to reflect on them. So, the thought that we could just vanish as a species is unsettling, and I came across a notion called the doomsday argument. And the doomsday argument was more or less advanced by an astrophysicist named Brandon Carter, who used a mathematical probability forum to speculate about the end of civilization or the end of the world. And he concluded that we have about a 5% chance of perishing within the next 200 years. But we have about a 95% chance that it would be something like 7,000 to 9,000 with some degrees of freedom. Because if you think about it, 95% chance that we're going to be gone, let's say 9,000 years, given the history of the human time frame, and given that we're slated to be overpopulated by 10 billion people in the next 20 or so years, and that you and I were the most people who have ever lived in the history of the human timeline as we speak, because the population's doubled from 4 billion to 8 billion since 1980. And we're among those people. So that's why, looking at these philosophers and mathematicians and scientists, I felt like, well, we're closer to the end than not. So I started to be more concerned about it. Now, we can dismiss that as a manipulation of math and statistics, but it's still looking at probabilities. And if you add all these other existential threats, those are multipliers. And it's a it's a call to think about what the future of humanity and our moral future should be. And so that's why I feel, you know, I feel a need to speak out and reflect on it, particularly from the standpoint of an ethical or philosophical position.
For me, it may have been a great thing, what they say, be a fly on the wall as you was researching and running into these truths and telling yourself, nah, this can't be possible. And then telling yourself, no, it can't be. And finding out this information and moving towards that amazing understanding that you had to battle yourself to really say, look, I think I have enough information to understand this. I could be occupying my time with so many things, but somebody has got to do something. And that is what I appreciate about you the most, that you could have just said, hey, I'll just take this information and use it as best. And that's what most people do. They just get the information and say, hey, this is how we're going to protect our family. But are you really changing the world? Are you really helping make change unless you make a statement such as writing a book such as yours and making sure that we as people are getting informed? Let's talk about important people in your life. You wrote this book for your daughters, Mackenzie, Chloe, and Ivy, with the hope that their children will inherit a better world. What does that look like for you, Dr. Mills?
Well, yes. I mean, I have kids that are ages 20, 24, and 35, and I have a grandson, too. And so I want them to not only be around in the future, but to have, you know, have a world that's thriving and better than what I'm experiencing. I think this is natural for anybody who's parent, that they want their children to have a better life than them. But also it is symbolic for future lives. I mean, isn't it an awfully selfish thing to do that we're going to pass on a wasted future for others? When we do have knowledge, I mean, it would be incredulous for anyone to say they didn't know, unless they just are ignorant or don't care to become informed or educated about all these events that affect us in our lives. But they would be, because they're affected every day by everything: politics, economy, societal pressures and conflicts. Everybody's affected in some level. That's my hope, is that basically I can't do anything as a human, as one human person, but other than speak out. And if we can get people to break out of this complacency. I mean, I can't even tell you. I tried to shop this book around, and nobody wants to touch it because it's got a bad feel to it. It's not, happy-go-lucky. It's not shiny, happy people and all of the wonderful optimism that everyone wants to hear, because it doesn't sell. It doesn't give the messaging that people want. And not only that, people have tried to suppress what I'm saying. And so it tells you how the politics of knowledge, of knowledge production, of epistemology is based upon trying to censor certain ideas. So to me, people should be able to listen to opposition, try to understand their perspective. You'll learn something from the other, even if you disagree. And don't feel like it's such a threat to your existence because somebody has different viewpoints. Look at it as a way of broadening your development, whether it be intellectually or psychically, as a human being.
You know, sometimes greatness, it develops, it just catches speed or catches fire. as things move on. Timing may be it. Maybe it's your beautiful family that's going to carry this on. But I know that you've already created and led this path in the right direction to let us stay alert and to be smart about some of the things that we need to understand as a society and as a people. And as you mentioned, there could be times that people struggle with information because we're novice in some of it. And in this novelty, we sometimes get caught up in the, because I don't know it, it doesn't sound attractive. It probably isn't what I need to hear. That's a do later or whatever that is. It is imperative for us to be open to understanding and sharing to say, hey, there is information here. I just didn't make it up. I got stats. I got research. I got data. I got all the things that we need to understand. And you are living it because we see weather climates like winter here hasn't been as cold as it used to be. I don't know back in Ontario, if it's, well, it's always cold over there. But for the most part, we have not seen winters as brisk in the last 3 years, at least here on the east side. Tell us a little bit about some of these challenges in writing this book. What were some of the things that you were coming up against, whether personal or just your thought processes? What, if there were any challenges, were there?
Well, there's many challenges because there's always a pressure on what do you do about it? And so, I mean, I got frustrated to the point that I'm thinking, I'm not going to be able to say anything new here. And what's even more disheartening is the problem is too big to fix. Mm. And I can't resolve it. I wish I could. What you can resolve are certain particular issues or problems. But massive systemic issues are so overwhelmingly complicated and nuanced that how do you even begin to introduce elements of change that would potentially alter a massive system? And what I'm talking about here, I'm talking about the world. I mean, so I can't be that grandiose to think I can do these things. So it would be up to individuals in their own areas, especially in their own disciplines, where they have a certain, you know, modicum of wisdom or control over what they can introduce. Mm-hmm. Not thinking that you're going to spread throughout the globe and affect everyone's attitudes. That would be that would be miraculous, and I would certainly encourage it. But human nature is such as that people don't want to hear what they don't want to hear. Mm-hmm. They're going to dismiss anything that goes against their mindset. And they are going to do whatever they can to hold on to self-interest. So, for instance, if we know that we need to decarbonize to some degree, not eliminate everything, but redistribute into renewables, and so we get the carbon footprint down, and science and reason and logos tells us that we should do that, because if we don't, we're just going to be setting up the stage for self-annihilation. Mm-hmm. But there's always going to be people in politics, in capitalistic and hegemonic power structures who do not want to give up whatever, their capital, their influence, and they'll do everything they can to, militate against change. So, yeah, go ahead.
You know, thinking outside the box, and we can name a few players, whether it's government, whether it is some sort of groups, organizations that we can pull out and say, these are the reasons why some of these things do not or will not happen. This sort of grouping is the type of information that may or may not dispel some of the positiveness about sharing this type of information, or maybe not. When we think about the environment, which is like low-hanging fruit here, what are some of the things that we can do as people to begin to change our fate, to make Earth a lot better? Are there ways that we can start, and do you have any tips for us?
Well, this is kind of a double-edged sword. On one hand, you know, people do things to make themselves feel good as citizens, you know, where they engage in environmental conservation to some degree, where they care about ecological justice. They are engaged in forms of whether it be recycling or whatever they do to try to reduce their carbon footprint, and they may feel good about that. Whether it be switching to renewables, to not burning so much gas, even becoming vegan, you know, you'll hear it all, right? But what I'm told is that what you do as one person is just like a grain of sand. It means nothing. It only means something to you that you feel good about what you're doing. And that has, of course, its own positive effects on wellness. So what that would mean is that one has to mobilize community efforts where you get more people to identify with your value system. And you get them here, we're talking about, you know, ecological, you know, whether it be rehabilitation or amelioration or restoration, but whatever it may be, get people involved in that, and you're going to then have more of a group that makes an impact. And also, of course, that would lead to pressures, whether it be social activism, whether it be electing the type of leaders and politicians that share your value system. Now, how do we get though the greater numbers of society on board when, you know, all of this is so abstract or so up in the air or so intangible, or it fights against this notion of why should I give up more when I can have some control over my immediate life and my family and what I do. And so this is the problem, is that we don't want to have to give up everything that makes our lives comfortable, because it just is a contradiction. It violates, you know, we're ambivalent about that. So often people don't want to have these sacrifices, not knowing what really will happen.
You know, thinking about the trajectory for me, even growing up, as technology has taken over, and we talked about artificial intelligence, you know, when we think about too much of something isn't no good, right? This has taken us by storm right now. Technology went from simply a computer to we can't communicate unless we use this and that. And now we're here asking a device to tell us how to do stuff. It's taking our jobs, it's making the world even more complex, because we are no longer socializing in the ways that we should as people. What are some of the areas that you are worried about when we think about artificial intelligence? And are there any positives, if any?
Well, yes, you're right. It seems that everybody lives in their cell phone. I'm a dinosaur, because I didn't have a cell phone until my wife made me get one. And I don't even, you know, carry it. I don't want people to think that I'm available 24/7 and they can just call or text. So I'm very resistant to relying on that. But most people do, and most people are born into that technology, whereas, you know, the internet was, you know, something that just popped up late in my life. Mm-hmm. So it's part of everyday life now. So if we are to listen to social scientists and social psychologists that are warning us about the overuse of social media and this type of technology, it's hard to deny that younger people are having more mental health problems.
Mm.
It just simply is. They live in a device, like some kind of virtual reality, rather than having to, to deal with the normativity of growing up. And yes, technology brings all kinds of good things. There's no question about it. And hopefully it will continue to improve our existences, our health in particular. Whether or not it leads to an AI takeover seems to me to be a little bit more of a hysterical overreaction to what we think technology will be, at least at this point in time. What the real problems, though, I think we will face is the age of disinformation. And because if we can't know what's true from what's not true based upon our reliance on media, or I should say social media, because even with media, you think there's some standards about truth and falsity, and that there are at least some regulation around what you can say. But most people don't even read the paper. They don't go to the direct sources, and they don't fact check. They just see a meme or something, and they assume it's true. Well, you could imagine a situation where AI can run wild if that's the case. Everything from computer hacking, information structures that are disabled, to communication networks, to banking, to hospitals, to industry, data theft, all that stuff. But if you could imagine bad actors deliberately wanting to spread the notion that, let's say, Russia or North Korea just launched a nuclear missile, and that sets in a mass panic, you don't know how other people are going to react. It could lead to immediate social disarray, and people make mistakes. There's errors, technological errors, bio errors. You can have terrorism that's using AI to achieve nefarious means. But if you were to say, right now I'm quite pessimistic about this kind of notion that machines are going to have super intelligences, that even if they surpass the human mind in intelligence, it doesn't mean that they're going to be a human being that has consciousness, that has free will, agency to want to take over the world and kill everybody. This seems like a paranoid kind of even psychotic fantasy projection. But there are people that are very serious in the industry that are talking about what happens if machine technology acquires this type of autonomy, and what happens if it has sinister plans. And this is the control problem. Mm-hmm. So whoever is developing all this stuff, let's hope there's at least some cooperation with various industries, people contributing, and that we have some oversight.
You know, I really like that you leaned on it. It removes the guessing, the interaction between two people, three people, maybe even groups. When someone can control and press a button behind a desk or somewhere and create without your knowledge, or create or tap into your own information without your knowledge, which is some of the things that I believe are scary about technology. It is powerful. It is something that people are still developing. But when you look at it, the ones who are controlling it still want more power. It brings us back to the way we first started. Everyone who does this, who has the ability to reach a number of people, use it to either bring fear or to empower themselves even more, which I think is very difficult, but yet very true, because many people who sought out these ideas see their growth, see their power, and utilize it. So let's be mindful about what information we are sharing. Think about it. It used to be a time that we would have to remember 9, 10, 15 different passwords, and don't use the same one because they may hack you and find the same password. But now your phone is like, do you want me to store it all for you? And now you put your face on it and it kind of tells your password, and it still does that. So there's a lot to be worried about, and there's a lot to be happy about. If we were to say, can you tell me, what do you want our readers to get or our listeners to get when they purchase your book?
Well, I hope they, get a different perspective from, that they haven't read before. So I think if I were to try to say what differentiates my approach to others that have tackled the field of existential risk, is I'm coming at it from a psychological point of view. And we should think about the notion that, are we global bystanders to ecological devastation? Are we failing to take the responsibility to act, to intervene? Just like someone on the street who is being mugged or beaten, that could be murdered right in front of our very eyes, and we fail to intervene. That would be one thing that I think is not something that most people have heard of. Also, the notion that we seem to be, involved in some kind of collective unconscious death wish. Mm-hmm. It's as if, collective humanity is bringing about our own demise by failing to intervene when we see the train wreck coming. And I just want people to get their head out of the sand, to realize that until we wake up from our unconscious stupor, and literally, that I think the world, social collectives or the masses are unconscious of what's going on. And so please become conscious. Please become aware. Please have some conversations about these important issues, because the stakes are very high. And that's what I'm hoping that people are going to get from it.
You know, there's an early phrase in your book when I started to browse through it. When people feel abused and experience no sense of justice, it violates a universal ethical principle, one that is shattered with the realization that there are no universal ethics. When I think about this, I think about the facts that people are misusing their own abilities and forget about what their real truths are. And we step away from truths and even things that we begin to value, we kind of lose our alignment, if you will, in areas that we're letting others lead. So I'm telling everyone, follow your heart, follow your values, and follow what you believe in. My friend, the floor is yours. Before we let you go, tell us, what do you want our listeners to remember about this movement and what we can do to help this movement get better?
Well, I should say you've been a great host, and I really valued this conversation. It's always so much more enjoyable to have a discussion with somebody rather than just for me to blab or pontificate about stuff. So thanks so much, Jules.
Thank you, Dr. Mills.
But I guess what I would hope, and in the at least I think it's possible, is that people need to develop a sense of empathy for the other. We need to have a sense of mutual recognition for each other and the differences between us. And right now we are so polarized and so divided to the degree that there's only one truth, and there's, you know, which is good, everything else is bad, and that we can't even have a dialogue, let alone a conversation or a meeting of minds that's based upon an ethic of recognition. So I'm hoping that we can, as societies and people and different cultures can embrace differences, and it's okay to have differences, and that we can engage in this kind of fruitful way of talking about what's important in terms of our values. And that's going to lead to something. I don't know what, but hopefully it will lead to at least some kind of unification.
Dr. John Mills beautifully said, we need to embrace one another. Just when you think you hit another dead end, something unexpected happens that changes everything, you keep pushing forward, because it will be lonely at the top. Because on this platform, it was built because way too often as people, we were overlooked or labeled and put in boxes. But this is no longer. Our plight and our fight is for anyone and everyone who feels a need to be understood. We are strong as individuals, but unstoppable when we unite. Tune in, friends, to another He's Just a Social Worker show, coming to another town real soon, near you. We're out. Thank you.
Please note that the views expressed here are my own and not a representation of my employers and clients. Thank you for listening. We're always here for you. Just message us and we'll get back to you within 24 hours. Thank you. More than just at He's Just a Social Worker. In memory of my mother, Matilde De La Rosa. This is dedicated to you, Mom. Miss you so much. En memoria de mi madre, Matilde de la Rosa, esto va dedicado a ti, mamá. Te extraño mucho.